So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And while we're changing subjects, I think that actually there's a lot of carryover from our discussion with Leanda Haupt about noticing what's around you in an urban environment and appreciating wildlife, whether common or rare. And we're going to talk now with Sam Thayer. He is a lifelong forager and the author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. He's an all-around naturalist, as was Leanda, and his passion for wild food extends to studying the origin of cultivated plants also, as well as the socioeconomic history of the human diet. He has been foraging since he first learned to do so in vacant lots, backyards, city parks, and at the edges of town. And he is joining us from our Eau Claire studio today. Hi, Sam.
Hello, Judith.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Sam, you, as I said, you really started foraging from a young age. For you, what's a good definition of foraging?
Well, when I was a child, I didn't know the word foraging. I just knew what free food was. And so I didn't differentiate whether I was, borrowing something from a neighbor's garden, or I was picking from an apple tree down the block, or I was picking some berries in the woods. But for me, it was just a way of getting free food to supplement my diet. As I grew older, I sort of refined that definition. So I'd say that most foragers see foraging as gathering food that hasn't been cultivated or grown for that purpose. And so that could be totally wild plants, but it could also be stray weeds in a city lot, or it could be trees that were planted in a park, not to produce nuts or berries that may be incidental, but they still may provide that. It's basically a way of just going out and reaping where you didn't sow. And foraging also usually encompasses all types of food. So that's plants, mushrooms, animals, fish. But most people, when they think of foraging, they think of gathering plants and mushrooms.
So by your definition, there happens to be, I'm not going to say exactly where because I don't want everybody running out there, but when I walk to the grocery store closest to me, there's a patch of raspberries that I'm not sure how they ended up there, but there are definitely some raspberry canes along the street that kind of border on a park, not in someone's yard. And they're just there. And I see other people going and actually, with little Tupperware containers, taking some home. I generally just take a couple for a treat on the way to the grocery store. So, and that's in Madison. So there is foraging to be done even in fairly urban areas.
Absolutely. I lived 8 years of my childhood in Madison, and I foraged all over town. There's all kinds of things to pick. Here on the way to Eau Claire, I saw black locust trees that are just coming into bloom all over town. They're planted in yards. They're in parks. They're along fence rows. They're along fences. They're almost anywhere you could imagine, and nobody cares if you do pick them from public places. So, yeah, and even in downtown of the largest cities in the world, there is stray vegetation just waiting for people to eat it.
And I'm assuming that some of those things that are, I like that term, stray vegetation, I mean, thanks to pollinators and birds moving things around, some things probably started as cultivated and, seeds or whatever got moved to somewhere else and took up residence that wherever they got dropped.
Sure. Some of our most common weeds originated as cultivated plants, such as wild parsnip, for example, very common throughout southern Wisconsin, came here as a garden vegetable, escaped from people's gardens, and now it's found all over the southern part of the state, extremely abundant. And as far as food value, it's identical to the cultivated parsnip. Mm.
But my understanding is, isn't wild parsnip considered an invasive at this point?
Any non-native plant growing outside of its natural range can be considered
an
invasive.
Over. Yeah.
Yeah. So as far as invasives go, it's not like buckthorn or poison hemlock or garlic mustard or a lot of these plants that really aggressively invade native ecosystems.
And take over. Yeah.
Right. Wild parsnip lives in man-made ecosystems, disturbed places. So, for example, if an agricultural field is abandoned, there'll be a lot of wild parsnip for the first 5 to 7 years, and then it'll slowly die out and give way to native perennial plants that are still considered weedies, like milkweed, dogbane, and goldenrod. So it's not as aggressive of an invasive plant. But when you know of an invasive plant, such as autumn olive or garlic mustard, that's edible, you can feel great about foraging for it, and you can use your foraging as part of your land management.
There you go. And I want to make sure that people know how they can join in the conversation, because I know there's a lot of interest in this topic. You can call 1-800-642-1234. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Erica Janik, our on-air producer today, will answer your call. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And you can comment on our Facebook page, which several people have done already. That's The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. Sam, one of the benefits to foraging that kind of popped into my head right away is that there are some things that you can forage for that you're never going to find, certainly not in a supermarket and probably not even at a farmer's market. What are some of those delicacies that are really only available if you go out and find them yourself?
You know, you hit it right on the head. To me, there's a lot of reasons to forage, but that's the number one reason, is there is so much food out there that is just great that you cannot buy it. I'll give you an example of what I picked yesterday. Black locust flowers, they don't have a long enough shelf life to ever be marketable. And so they're only available to those people that would go out and pick them themselves. And they are so fantastic. I cannot recommend highly enough trying them. The flavor is like a sweet pea with a very strong vanilla overtone. It's just intoxicating scent and this delicious mild flavor that anyone that likes food would like. Another thing that's in season right now is the stalks of a plant called salsify or goat's beard. And most people recognize this plant because you see it along roadsides or railroad tracks. When people will call it the giant dandelion. It has a small yellow flower, but then a big fluffy head about 3 inches in diameter of parachuted seeds like dandelions have in early to midsummer. Well, earlier than that, like right about now, the shoots are coming up. They're tender like asparagus, but they have a flavor like sweet corn. Just absolutely delicious. I think it's the best vegetable I've ever tasted, but you can't buy it anywhere.
Wow. Well, I think everybody's going to be looking out their car windows trying to find that. Lois in Palmyra has a question for you, so let's go to here. Hi, Lois.
Good morning. Good morning. Really enjoying this program, and don't know much about it, but I pick asparagus. We've done that for years, and the mulberries and all that around. But my question to him was, what was his greatest find? Or, I mean, you know, something that you just would go crazy over if you were foraging and found it. And with his experience, I thought it was just kind of interesting as to what his favorite is.
Well, that's an interesting question, because one thing I see is that people like to look for the things that are hardest to find. So the things like, I'll go out and look for morels every year, and I love finding the morels, but I'm not guaranteed to find morels. This year I found about a pound and a half one day. Some years I'll find 15 pounds. But the things that excite me the most are not the things that are hard to find. They're the things that I know I can find, because I can look forward to them all year. And it's really hard for me to say one particular thing, because there's probably 75 plants that I would feel terrible if I missed for the year. Yesterday, another thing I collected were burdock stalks. And that's something, you know, it's in season for only about a week to 2 weeks, depending on the weather. And I'd feel terrible if I missed that. But I guess if I had to pick one, like, dream find, it would maybe be a really, really loaded serviceberry tree that had just the best, sweetest serviceberries you could find. And this has to be my favorite fruit. But there's probably 15 close second choices that I would be 97% as delighted to find.
Thanks for that call, Lois. And Lois mentioned asparagus, and Victoria mentioned on Facebook, we forage for wild asparagus every spring. Didn't get much this year because of the heat. So not only are there things that are seasonal, but then it sounds like there are particular crops or plants that may or may not be there, as you were saying, or maybe they're in greater or lesser quantities, depending on the conditions that particular year.
Oh, yeah. Well, what we had this year was a cold spring, and then suddenly it turned almost to summer. So a lot of those plants responded by growing extraordinarily fast, so their normal season where you could collect the shoots was shortened, while other plants, earlier spring plants, had a very long, drawn-out season, like wild leeks. For example, they had a long season because of that long, cool spell just after the snow melted, but before it got warm enough for the trees to leaf out. So every year is good for some things. Every year is bad for some things.
And there was another question that just went up on Facebook. Are there any lookalikes for wild asparagus, or is it pretty easy to spot?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the idea of lookalikes is sort of based on not being certain of the identity of the plant you're looking for. And you shouldn't be eating any plant unless you are certain of its identity. So if you are familiar with asparagus, you know asparagus, you've picked it for years, you've had it in the garden or you collect it in the wild, there is no plant you're going to see and think, aha, that's asparagus. Just like you never pick up a banana and think, wait a second, what if this is not a banana?
Mm-hmm.
You know what a banana is.
And so, actually, Sam, we're going to need to take a break for the news now, but I want to make sure that we talk more about resources for identifying things so people can get out there and start foraging or be better foragers if they are already. We're talking with Sam Thayer, a lifelong forager and the author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we are talking with Sam Thayer, who is a lifelong forager and the author of The Forager's Harvest and also Nature's Garden. And Sam, I wanted to mention that Nature's Garden recently won some awards.
Yeah, it did. It won a Midwest Book Award in the nature category. It also won a silver medal in the Benjamin Franklin Awards, which is sponsored by the Independent Publishers Association.
Well, congratulations on that. And I also know that you wanted to share some information about the upcoming Wild Food Summit with our listeners. And also going back to the call that was before the news, you know, especially if you're just starting out, but like anything, as you want to develop your skills, it's really helpful to kind of have, you know, central resources where you can talk to people and see things and smell things and touch things and learn from others. What is the Wild Food Summit and when is it happening?
The Wild Food Summit is the weekend of, I think it goes from June 16th to the 18th or 19th. It starts on Thursday. And it takes place in northwestern Minnesota on the White Earth Indian Reservation. And this is an event where around 100 people from about a five-state area get together and share wild food experiences and recipes and camp out, cook wild dishes. And then throughout each day, there's different educational events, plant identification, mushroom identification, some plant ecology, cooking demonstrations and workshops. So all kinds of neat stuff. It's a nice setting on a lake so people can canoe and fish in their spare time. But it's all primitive camping for this event. And this is the sixth annual event. It's really a lot of fun.
And you mentioned that it's on native lands. One of the questions I wanted to make sure we touched on was, how do different cultures forage differently and for what, from Native American cultures to various European immigrant communities? I know my Polish relatives were pretty crazed mushroom hunters.
Yeah, you know, each culture seems to have a certain suite of plants or mushrooms that they used, and it's often interesting to compare them. For example, it seems that the Native Americans in the Midwest used very few mushrooms, whereas people from Europe coming over, most of the European cultures other than from England and Ireland used a lot of mushrooms. So as you go east into Europe, mushroom hunting was more and more popular. Poland, Lithuania, Russia, people from those cultures have often kept that tradition as they have come to the United States. And probably most of our mushroom collecting is done by European immigrants, either in the first or second generation. Native Americans in at least in Wisconsin, had extraordinary knowledge of wild food plants. Today, there's a smaller subset of those plants that are still traditionally harvested. Wild rice and maple syrup are well known. Blueberries, service berries, and choke cherries are still collected by a lot of native people in northern Wisconsin, as well as cranberries. And these were all staple important foods before Europeans arrived here. And, you know, the literature on edible wild plants is really based on kind of a conglomeration of all these different cultures and everything we could learn from cultures around the world. One thing that fascinates me is how plants might be popular in one part of the world and completely ignored in another. Hmm. So, for example, we have a very common plant throughout Wisconsin called honewort or wild chervil. It doesn't really even have a commonly accepted common name. Well, this plant is called Mitsuba in Japan, and it is also native to Japan, and it is a commonly cultivated vegetable there, very popular, and it is almost unknown and almost completely ignored in North America. And so often by reading about the plants used in different cultures, we can learn about the things that are literally in our backyard that are great vegetables that we don't eat. But I would like to return to the question before the break.
Sure.
About lookalikes. That's a very important question. And I guess the more succinct way to answer that is that if you're not real familiar with the plant, there might be many things that look similar, but once you are thoroughly familiar, once you've gone through the process of carefully identifying a plant, probably nothing will look the same. So if you're at the stage where you're worried about lookalikes, you are not ready to eat the plant. You're not worried about lookalikes for red raspberries, probably. Then you're ready to eat red raspberries. Hmm. And this holds true for all of the plants out there. You know, identifying a plant can be a tricky process. It might take a while. The first step is what I call your tentative identification, and it might be, hey, I think that's wild asparagus. And if you had no clue, your next step would be to compare it to references that, you know, they gave you the physical features of the plant described. And if this plant matches a field guide's description of the plant you're looking at, then you would cross-reference, get another field guide, or ask another knowledgeable person. If everything still fits, then you do what I call a specimen search. You look for more specimens of that plant to become certain that you can spot it repeatedly. And after that specimen search, if you have no troubles, that's when you're probably ready to actually eat the plant. People sometimes mistakenly think, aha, I think that's an autumn olive. And they think they're done identifying it. It's just a hunch. It's just a supposition. Mm-hmm. You're not ready to eat it on just a hunch. And surprisingly, the vast majority of poisonings that occur for people collecting plants or mushrooms occur when people eat a random plant or mushroom without having any idea what it is. And that's obviously a no-no, but people just still do it.
Hmm.
And that's where the problem arises. As far as poisonings that occur from people misidentifying plants, that is extraordinarily rare because we have this innate sense. You don't eat something unless you actually know what it is.
That's a great point. We have some people that have been waiting oh so patiently to talk with you, Sam. So let's go to the phone and get to some of those calls. Kate in Stevens Point is first. Hi, Kate.
Hello. First of all, I consider myself a bioregional animist, so I do look for things to forage on for my health. But and I started foraging when I was a young girl, helping people in their gardens. But my real nature of this call is to ask if you've heard anything about foraging in certain municipalities becoming outlaw. And I bring this up because 2 years ago when I was in San Francisco, I read a front page article about foraging in the city parks will be illegal.
Have you heard anything about that, Sam?
I've heard about that case and only that case. And it is a little bit disturbing to me. My personal take on it is, you know, foragers need to be responsible and respectful about what they collect. There was a fairly famous case where a forager ate a dandelion in Central Park and was arrested for it. And most people can recognize that, that's ridiculous. There are certainly times and places where foragers need to not collect, and there are preserved lands, and we need to respect that. And foragers generally do respect that very much. But to say you can't collect mushrooms that pop up in a city park is fairly ridiculous, because it shows a misunderstanding of mushroom ecology. That's no different than picking an apple off of an apple tree. It doesn't hurt the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it as somewhat of a class struggle. It's kind of a tacit, it's kind of that, you know, foraging is associated with immigrants and poor people, and
test
we don't
one, two,
want
three, four,
that.
5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Sam.
I wouldn't say it's categorically bad by any means that foraging is not allowed in certain places. I think in Wisconsin, there's a very reasonable attitude. For instance, our state parks allow people to pick berries, but not to pick, you know, we can pick berries or nuts or mushrooms, but we can't pick whole plants. And I think that's a real reasonable attitude to have. So hopefully that's not a trend that continues in other municipalities around the country.
Thanks for that call, Kate. And let's go to Jeff in Hanover, Iowa. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, Judith. Good afternoon, Sam. I want to go back to an earlier portion of the show where you mentioned the wild parsnip. Is that the same wild parsnip with the blisteringly phototoxic properties? And if it is, what's the best way to harvest?
Okay, that's a great question. It is the same wild parsnip, and many people are surprised when I tell them that the cultivated parsnip, the parsnip that if you have bought the seeds in your local garden center and grow in your garden, that parsnip has exactly the same blistering quality as the wild parsnip. It is not like poison ivy where you can just brush against the plant and get this rash. You actually have to get the juice on your skin. And it has to be sunny to activate that juice. And in that case, you will get terrible blisters. And I have a friend who's an organic farmer who got these blisters while harvesting parsnips from his farm last year. So you can get it from wild or cultivated parsnips. The key is not to get the juice on you. It's rarely a problem with parsnips when you're harvesting them, because in the fall the leaves do not have much juice in them and it tends not to be hot and sunny, but most importantly the leaves aren't very juicy. Parsnip rash normally is contracted when people decide they're going to expand their lawn and they may take a brush hog or a riding lawnmower and cut some parsnips this time of year. June, when the stalks are growing very vigorously, they're very juicy, and then they may remove that material from the mower, or they may move some of that material manually and they'll get it on their skin, or they may walk through a patch of parsnip and break some stalks, and the second year stalks are very juicy, and they'll get the juice on their arms or on their chest, and then they get the rash from it. So it's just important to be aware that that juice is what will cause the reaction. If you get it on you, wash it off right away. It is virtually never a problem with harvesting parsnips because you don't harvest them in their second year when they're particularly juicy. You harvest them when they have only that basal rosette of leaves, and you don't harvest them in early summer, which is when they're most potent.
That's a great clarification, Jeff. And did you have a second question?
Just a statement. I wanted to mention one thing that my wife and I subscribe to deeply. When we find a patch of morels or a patch of trout lilies or spring beauties or whatever, we never harvest the entire patch. We always leave some back for sustainability. No matter, you don't know what the season is going to be next year, but you always leave some back.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for saying that. I can't emphasize that enough. And one thing that I think is great about foraging is it stimulates people to be concerned about their environment. It makes people aware of their environment. I like to say that we only love what we know, and we only protect what we love, and we only love what we know or what we're familiar with. When people go out and collect plants, they become immensely more aware of the ecology around them and pay attention to that stuff. So for each plant that you harvest, you develop a relationship with that plant. You become deeply concerned about it, and you automatically kind of develop the sense of stewardship for that plant. And absolutely, you need to understand how fast a plant reproduces and how much is appropriate to harvest, or if it's not appropriate to harvest any in some situations. And I emphasize that when I'm collecting plants and in my books for every single plant. You need to keep this in mind. It might be something like garlic mustard, where the more you pick, the better. Or it might be something like you mentioned, trout lily and spring beauty. Very common plants in some areas, but very slow growing. So you need to collect only a very small portion of what's there.
And stewardship, I think, is the perfect word for that. That you're really taking some responsibility to tending that, even though it's wild and it's not something that's cultivated. That doesn't mean that we can't be good stewards of those resources. Thanks so much for that call, Jeff. And let's go to Gigi in Viroqua. Hi, Gigi.
Hi. This spring at a local restaurant. May I say the name of the restaurant?
Sure.
Optimo in Viroqua.
Okay.
They served nettles and ramps. Mm-hmm. And I'm not familiar with either, and my favorite was ramps. Are you familiar with ramps?
Well, yeah, ramps are also called wild leeks. The name ramps comes from a very similar plant that grows in Europe. In England, it's called rampsen, and it was shortened to ramps when we came over here for some reason. That's a wild relative of onions, and it's very common in northern Wisconsin. It's locally common in southwestern Wisconsin, and then nettles, they may be serving either stinging nettle or wood nettle. They both are native, have similar flavors, but quite different textures. I think they're both excellent vegetables when they're prepared right. How are they served?
Well, as a garnish or stuffed in a trout. And the ramps were so pleasantly mild, not like an onion at all.
Yeah, if they're cooked well, they're very very good. However, I personally I have a little bit of a problem with ramps being served in restaurants, because they are one of the only wild foods that do have an issue with over exploitation. There are a number of wild stands in the southwestern part of the state that have been exterminated by over collection. And I occasionally, when I'm out foraging, will find these over collected spots. They're extremely slow growing, so people can get the notion, oh, well, there's tons of these here. I can just pick loads of them. Well, one little patch could be 30 to 70 years old. They grow in clones. And so a patch that's about 12 inches in diameter is usually 15 to 20 years old. And so commercial harvesters sometimes over-collect them. But the personal harvester, the person collecting for their own use, doesn't have the tendency to do that.
Now, nettles are an interesting thing, Sam, because I have to say I had a rather unpleasant up-close-and-personal experience with stinging nettles in France and thought that my leg was going to explode because I had brushed up against it. But my understanding is that even the stinging nettles, if they're prepared, and they don't have to, I think sometimes people way overcook them just to be sure, but just lightly steamed or sautéed, they lose that whatever that property is that can give you a really horrid burning rash, and they're delicious.
Yeah. Nettles, it just takes a very quick cooking to destroy their stinging property. And think of it this way. They have to sting because they're so darn edible and so good that if they didn't sting, the deer would absolutely demolish them. I mean, deer will actually go through nettle patches, and they will select the nettles with the fewest stingers and eat them. So they're under constant pressure to produce more stingers. They are so high in protein and so delectable that they are just a great food source, and they are one of the most commonly used wild greens in the entire world.
Thanks for that call. Matt in La Crosse would like to join in, so let's go to Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for the call, the opportunity to call in. I just wanted to ask a question about the legality of picking. I know that I've talked with, I live in La Crosse, and I do a lot of foraging along county roads, and I've called the county transportation department, and they tell me that it's the road right-of-way is 66 feet usually. Occasionally it's a little bit less or a little bit more, and it's 33 feet from the center lane out, and they've assured me that it's perfectly legal to go and to do things that are in accordance with Wisconsin law, as in you know, picking parts of plants that will regrow, won't harm the whole plant. Yet I have been stopped on only one occasion by a county sheriff's deputy just this past year in southeast La Crosse County, and they said, no, you can't do that. This is all private property. You're trespassing, you know, leave now, stop. And I asked for a citation. They wouldn't give me a citation. So I was thought that was a little fishy. And I just thought maybe you could comment on that. That would be great. Thanks.
Well, you know, I'm in exactly the same boat as you are. I have the vast majority of foraging, to be realistic and honest, takes place on the side of country roads. Rural people stop along the side of the road. They pick raspberries. They pick asparagus. They pick strawberries. And generally, nobody cares. And it is legal. Technically, it is legal. And I do that too. But if I know that a particular person doesn't want me there, I'll leave. Some people feel like, hey, you're on the side of the road that runs along my property. Get away. I don't want you there. And I'll just leave. But technically, it's my understanding that that is legal. It doesn't seem to be well hashed out or well understood. There's not a lot of us foraging, so I think that law enforcement hasn't been forced to wrangle with these issues and decide for certain. A couple years ago, I was picking lotus nuts in the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Refuge, which, according to their regulations, is perfectly legal. But I was harassed for about 2 hours by a DNR warden who was certain that it was illegal. But he couldn't find any way that it was illegal. He couldn't give me a ticket. He just wanted to bother me enough that I would stop doing it. And it didn't work because I knew it was legal. I've very carefully read the regulations for the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Refuge, and it's totally allowed. So some people are uncomfortable with foraging. I almost think that there's an instinct of, oh, they're getting my stuff. This is my territory. I don't know what they're collecting, but it's in my territory. I got to stop them. And, you know, so there's a strange element of that. But I can't say for sure for every, you know, every municipality in the state or every jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that call, Matt. Laura had a question on Facebook. Do you have any recommendations for a small guide or an app for a smartphone that would be a good guide for edible plants in Wisconsin?
You know, there was recently an iPhone app, not a smartphone, I think an iPhone app put out by Steve Brill. And I don't remember what that is called. As far as small field guide, there's a Peterson field guide, which is essentially a long list of edible wild plants with okay pictures in it. But the problem is with that approach is that I tell people, you just learn plants one at a time. Don't try to get a book that's going to cover 300 or 400 of them, because it can't do it thoroughly enough to give you that confidence and identification that you need before you put something in your mouth. And I can't emphasize enough that foraging is something that you should learn one plant at a time. There are quite a few good books on edible wild plants that have come out in the last 6 or 7 years. And I would say, you know, get 4 or 5 field guides. I know that might sound like a lot, but this is really the only legitimate way to learn is to get 4 or 5 good field guides for your region.
And other than field guides, Sam, are there any tools that are good to have maybe in the car or in a backpack ready to go?
Well, a cooler is great. I always forget to have one, but especially this time of year in this weather, you might pick some vegetables, and if you're not going to be going home right away, they're going to be just wilted and you know, sometimes practically melted by the time you get home. So it's really nice to have a cooler in the car, even if you don't have ice in it. It will keep the plants that much fresher. You know, I like to make sure I have a thumbnail so that it helps me. Helps me pinch off shoot vegetables when I collect them. Some people bring a scissors, but I tell you, a thumbnail is a lot easier.
Well, Sam, we're going to have to leave it there. Obviously, a lot more we could talk about, so we'll definitely have to have you back. Sam Thayer is a lifelong forager and author of The Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And stay tuned on the Ideas Network.